George remained in Hagbard's room and reflected on what had happened. He had no urge to scribble in his diary, the usual defense against silence and aloneness since his early teens. Instead, he savored the stillness of the room and of his inner core. He remembered St. Francis of Assisi called his body Brother Ass, and Timothy Leary used to say when exhausted, "The robot needs sleep." Those had been their mantras, their defenses against the experience of the mountaintop and the terrible arrogance it triggered. He remembered, too, the old classic underground press ad, "Keep me high and I'll ball you forever." He felt sorry for the woman who had written that pitiful modern version of the maddened St. Simon on his pillar in the desert. And Hagbard was right. Any dog or cat could do it, could make the jump to the mountaintop and wait without passion until the robot, Brother Ass, survived the ordeal or perished in it. That was what primitive rites of initiation were all about, driving the youth through sheer terror to the point of letting go, the mountaintop point, and then bringing him back down again. George suddenly understood how his generation, in rediscovering the sacred drugs, had failed to rediscover their proper use. Had failed, or had been prevented. The Illuminati, it was clear, didn't want any competition in the godmanship business. You could talk it to death in your own head as well as in conversation, he realized, but he went back over it again, trying to dissect it without mutilating it. The homosexuality bit had been a false front, with its own reality, of course, like all false fronts. Behind that was the conditioned terror against the robot, the fear symbolized in Frankenstein and dozens of other archetypes that if it were let loose, unrestrained, the robot would run amok, murder, rape, go mad. And then Hagbard had waited until the Almout Black brought him to freedom, showed him the peak, the place where the cortex at last could idle, as a car motor or a dog or cat idles, the last refuge where the catatonic hides. When George was safely in that harbor, Hagbard produced the gun. In a more primitive or more sophisticated society, it would have been the emblem of a powerful demon. And George saw that he could, indeed, idle there, and not blindly follow the panic signals from the robot's adrenaline factory. And because he was a human and not a dog, the experience had been ecstasy to him, and temptation. So Hagbard, with a few words and a glance from those eyes, pushed him off the peak into... what? Reconciliation was the word. Reconciliation with the robot, with the robot, with himself. The peak was not a victory, it was the war, the eternal war against the robot, carried to a higher and more dangerous level. The end of the war was his surrender, the only possible end to that war, since the robot was 3 billion years old and couldn't be killed. There were two great errors in the world, he perceived. The error of the submissive hordes, who fought all their lives to control the robot and please their masters, and who always sabotaged every effort without knowing it, and were, in turn, sabotaged by the robot's revenge, neuroses, psychoses, and all the tiresome list of psychosomatic ailments. And the error of those who recaptured the animal art of letting the robot run itself, and who then tried to maintain this split from their own flesh indefinitely, until they were lost forever in that eternally widening chasm. One sought to batter the robot to submission, the other to slowly starve it. Both were wrong. And yet, on another plane of his still-zonked mind, George knew that even this was a half-truth, that he was, indeed, just beginning his journey, not arriving at his destination. He rose and walked to the bookshelves and, as he expected, found a stack of Hagbard's little pamphlets on the bottom. "Never Whistle While You're Pissing," by Hagbard Chilene, HMSH. He wondered what the HM and SH stood for, then flipped open to the first page, where he found only the large question,
"Who is the one more trustworthy than all the Buddhas and sages?"
George laughed out loud.
"The robot, of course. Me, George Dorn. All 3 billion years worth of evolution in every gene and chromosome of me."
And that, of course, was what the Illuminati, and all the petty would-be Illuminati who made up power structures everywhere, never wanted a man or woman to realize. George turned to the second page and began reading.
"If you whistle while you're pissing, you have two minds where one is quite sufficient. If you have two minds, you are at war with yourself. If you're at war with yourself, it's easy for an external force to defeat you. This is why Meng Tse wrote, "A man must destroy himself before others can destroy him."
That was all, except for an abstract drawing on page 3 that seemed to suggest an enemy figure moving out toward the viewer. About to turn to page 4, George got a shock. From another angle, the drawing was two figures engaged in attacking each other. I and it, the mind and the robot. His memory leaped back 22 years, and he saw his mother lean over his crib and remove his hand from his penis.
Christ, no wonder I grab it when I'm frightened. The robot's revenge. The return of the repressed.
George started to turn the page again and saw another trick in Hagbard's abstraction. From a third angle, it might be a couple making love. In a flash, he saw his mother's face above his crib again, in better focus, and recognized the concern in her eyes. The cruel hand of repression was moved by love. She was trying to save him from sin. And Carlo, dead 3 years now, together with the rest of that Morta Trudy group, what had inspired Carlo when he and the four others, all of them less than 18, George remembered, blasted their way into a God's Lightning rally and killed 3 cops and 4 Secret Service agents in their attempts to gun down the Secretary of State? Love. Nothing but mad love. The door opened and George tore his eyes from the text. Mavis, back again in her sweater and slacks outfit, walked in.
For proclaimed right-wing anarchist, she sure dresses a lot like a new leftist,
George thought.
But then Hagbard wrote like a cross between Reichian leftist and an egomaniacal Zen master.
There was obviously more to the Discordian philosophy than he could grasp yet, even though he was now convinced it was the system he himself had been groping toward for many years. She said.
I like that smell. Alamout Black?
Yeah,
George said, having trouble meeting her eyes.
Hagbard's been illuminating me.
I can tell. Is that why you suddenly feel uncomfortable with me?
George met her eyes, then looked away again. There was tenderness there, but it was, as he had suspected, sisterly at best. He muttered,
"It's just that I realize our sex..."
Why couldn't he say fucking, or at least bawling?
"...was less important to you than to me."
Mavis took Hagbard's chair and smiled at him affectionately.
"You're lying, George. You mean it was more important to me than to you?"
She began to refill the pipe.
Christ God,
George thought.
Did Hagbard send her in here to take me to the next stage, whatever it is? "Well, I guess I mean both,"
he said cautiously.
"You were more emotionally involved than I was then, but now I'm more emotionally involved. And I know that what I want, I can't have. Ever."
"Ever is a long time. Let's just say you can't have it now."
"Humility is endless,"
George repeated.
"Don't start feeling sorry for yourself. You've discovered that love is more than a word in poetry, and you want it right away. You just had 2 other things that used to be just words to you, Sunyata and Satori. Isn't that enough for one day?"
"I'm not complaining. I know that humility is endless. Also means surprise is endless. Hagbard promised me a happy truth, and that's it."
Mavis finally got the pipe lit and, after toking deeply, passed it over.
"You can have Hagbard,"
she said. George, sipping very lightly since he was still fairly high, mumbled,
"Hagbard will love you as well as ball you. Of course, it's not the same. He loves everybody. I'm not at that stage yet. I can only love my equals."
She grinned wickedly.
"Of course, I can still get horny about you. But now that you know there's more than that, you want the whole package deal, right? So try Hagbard."
George laughed, feeling suddenly lighthearted.
"Okay, I will."
"Bullshit,"
Mavis said bluntly.
"You're putting us both on. You've liberated some of the energies, and right away, like everybody else at this stage, you want to prove that there are no blocks anywhere anymore. That laugh was not convincing, George. If you have a block, face it. Don't pretend it isn't there."
"Humility is endless,"
George thought.
"You're right,"
he said, unabashed.
"That's better. At least you didn't fall into feeling guilty about the block. That's an infinite regress. The next stage is to feel guilty about feeling guilty. And pretty soon you're back in the trap again, trying to be the governor of the nation of Dorne."
"The robot,"
George said. Mavis toked and said,
Hmm?
I call it the robot.
You picked that up from Leary back in the mid-60s. I keep forgetting you were a child prodigy. I can just see you with your eyeglasses and your shoulders all hunched, poring over one of Tim's books when you were 8 or 9. You must have been quite a child. They've sure mulled you over since then, haven't they?
It happens to most prodigies, and non-prodigies too, for that matter.
Yeah, 8 years grade school, 4 high school, 4 college, then postgraduate studies. Nothing left but the robot at the end. The ever-rebellious nation of me, with poor old I sitting on the throne trying to govern it.
There's no governor anywhere,
George quoted.
You are coming along nicely.
That's Juan Zhou, the Taoist philosopher. But I never understood him before.
So that's where Hagbard stole it. He has little cards that say, there's no enemy anywhere, and ones that say, there's no friend anywhere. He said once he could tell in 2 minutes which card was right for a particular person, to jolt them awake.
But words alone can't do it. I've known most of the words for years.
Words can help, in the right situation, if they're the wrong words. I mean, the right words. No, I do mean the wrong words.
They laughed, and George said,
Are we just goofing, or are you taking up the liberation of the nation of Dorne, where Hagbard left off?
Just goofing. Hagbard did tell me that you had passed one of the gateless gates and that I might drop in, after you had a while alone.
A gateless gate. That's another one I've known for years, without understanding it. The gateless gate and the governorless nation, the chief cause of socialism, is capitalism. What the hell does that bloody apple have to do with all this?
The apple is the world. Who did Goddess say owns it?
The prettiest one.
Who is the prettiest one?
You are.
Don't make a pass right now. Think.
George giggled.
I've been through too much already. I think I'm getting sleepy. I have 2 answers, one communist and 1 fascist. Both are wrong, of course. The correct answer has to fit in with your anarcho-capitalism.
Not necessarily. Anarcho-capitalism is just our trip. We don't mean to impose it on everybody. We have an alliance with an anarcho-communist group called the Jams. John Dillinger's their leader.
Come off it. Dillinger died in 1935 or something.
John Dillinger's alive and well today in California, Fernando Poo in Texas.
Mavis smiled.
As a matter of fact, he shot John F. Kennedy.
Give me another toke. If I have to listen to this, I might as well be in a state where I won't try to understand it.
Mavis passed the pipe.
The prettiest one has quite a few levels to it, like all good jokes. I'll give you the Freudian one, as beginners. You know the prettiest one, George? You gave it to the apple just yesterday. Every man's penis is the prettiest thing in the world to him. From the day he's born until the day he dies, it never loses its endless fascination. And I kid you not, baby, the same is true of every woman and her pussy. It's the closest thing to a real, blind, helpless love and religious adoration that most people ever achieve. But they'd rather die than admit it. Homosexuality, the urge to kill, petty spites and treacheries, fantasies of sadism, masochism, transvestism, any weird thing you can name. They'll confess all that in a group therapy session. But that deep, submerged, constant narcissism, that perpetual mental masturbation, is the earliest and most powerful block. They'll never admit it.
From what I've read of psychiatric literature, I thought most people had rather squeamish and negative feelings about their genitals.
That, to quote Freud himself, is a reaction formation. The primordial emotional tone, from the day the infant discovers the incredible pleasure centers there, is perpetual astonishment, awe, and delight, no matter how much society tries to crush it and repress it. For instance, everybody has some pet name for their genitals. What's yours?
Polyphemus,
he confessed.
What?
Because it has one eye, you know? Also, Polyphemus rhymes with penis, I guess. I mean, I can't remember exactly what my mental process was when I invented that in my early teens.
Polyphemus was a giant, too. Almost a god. You see what I mean about the primary emotional tone? It's the origin of all religion. Adoration of your own genitals and of your lover's genitals. There's Pan, Pangenitor, and the Great Mother.
So,
George said owlishly, still not sure whether this was profundity or nonsense.
The earth belongs to our genitalia?
to their offspring and their offspring's offspring and so on forever. The world is a verb, not a noun.
The prettiest one is 3 billion years old.
You've got it, baby. We're all tenants here, including the ones who think they're owners. Property is impossible.
Okay, I think I've got most of it. Property is theft because the Illuminati land titles are arbitrary and unjust. And so are their banking charters and railroad franchises and all of the other monopoly games of capitalism.
Of state capitalism, not of true laissez-faire.
Wait. Property is impossible because the world is a verb. A burning house, as Buddha said. All things are fire. My old pal Heraclitus. So property is theft and property is impossible. How do we get to property is liberty?
Without private property, there can be no private decisions.
So we're back where we started from.
No, we're one flight higher up on the spiral staircase. Look at it that way. Dialectically, as your Marxist friends say.
But we are back at private property, after proving it's an impossible fiction.
The statist form of private property is an impossible fiction, just like the statist form of communal property is an impossible fiction. Think outside the state framework, George. Think of property and freedom.
George shook his head.
It beats the hell out of my ass. All I can see is people ripping each other off. The war of all against all, as what's-his-name said.
Hobbes.
Hobbes, snobs, jobs, whoever, whatever, isn't he right?
Stop the motor on this submarine.
What?
Force me to love you.
Wait, I don't.
Turn the sky green or red instead of blue.
I still don't get it.
Mavis took a pen off the desk and held it between two fingers.
What happens when I let go of this?
It falls.
Where do you sit if there are no chairs?
On the floor. If I wasn't so stoned, I would have had it by then. Sometimes drugs are more of a hindrance than a help. On the ground, I added.
On your ass, that's for sure. The point is, if the chairs all go away, you still sit. Or you build new chairs.
She was stoned, too. Otherwise, she'd be explaining it better, I realized.
But you can't stop the motor without learning something about marine engineering first. You don't know what switch to pull or switches. And you can't change the sky, and the pen will fall without a gravity-governing demon rushing into the room to make it fall.
Shit and pink petunias, I said disgustedly. Is this some form of Thomism? Are you trying to sell me the natural law argument? I can't buy that at all.
Okay, George. Here's the next jolt. Keep your asshole tight.
She spoke to the wall, to a hidden microphone, I guessed.
Send him in now.
The robot is easily upset. My sphincter was already tightening as soon as she warned me there was a jolt coming, and she didn't really need to add that bit about my asshole. Carlo and his gun, Hagbard and his gun, Drake's mansion. I took a deep breath and waited to see what the robot would do. A panel in the wall opened, and Harry Coyne was pushed into the room. I had time to think that I should have guessed. In this game where both sides were playing with illusion constantly, Coyne's death could have been faked. Artificial intestines dangling and all. And of course Mavis and her raiders could have taken him out of Mad Dog jail, even before they took me out, of course. And I remembered the pain when he slapped my face, and when his cock entered me, and the robot was already moving. I hardly had time to aim, of course, and then his head was banging against the wall, blood spurting from his nose, and I had time to clip him again, on the jaw as he went down, of course. And then I came all the way back and stopped myself as I was about to kick him in the face as he lay there unconscious, Zen in the art of face punching. I had knocked a man out with two blows. I, who hated Hemingway and Machismo so much that I'd never taken a boxing lesson in my life. I was breathing hard, but it was good and clean. The feeling of after an orgasm, the adrenaline was flowing. But a fight reflex instead of a flight reflex had been triggered. And now, it over. And I was calm. A glint in the air. Hagbard's pistol was in Mavis's hand, then flying toward me. As I caught it, she said,
"Finish the bastard."
But the rage had ended when I held back the kick on seeing him already unconscious. "No," I said. "It is finished."
"Not until you kill him. You're no good to us until you're ready to kill, George."
I ignored her and rapped on the wall. "Haul the bastard out," I said clearly. The panel opened, and two Slavic-looking seamen, grinning, grabbed Coyne's arms and dragged him out. The panel closed again, quietly. "I don't kill on command," I said, turning back to Mavis. "I'm not a German shepherd or a draftee. My case with him is settled. And if you want him dead, do the dirty work yourself." But Mavis was smiling placidly.
"Is that a natural law?"
she asked.